Welcome to I'd Love to Know, a podcast about aging and how it affects our appearance. But looking young starts with feeling young. So we will explore ways not only to improve our appearance, but our health and our minds. I'm your host, Michael J. Lee, a board-certified plastic surgeon with over 20 years of experience helping people look the way they feel. Join me as I interview leaders in their fields and thought-provoking guests as we uncover the ways to live our best potential life. I'm so excited to talk to Dr. Lauren Stryker today and get the real information on hormone therapy for women. With social media and the internet, and yes, even podcasts, the role of hormone therapy and what the real benefits are have been confusing and contradictory for a lot of people. And who better to help us navigate the data and the thoughts of hormone replacement than Dr. Lauren Stryker? She's a clinical professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern, a best-selling author on several books on women's health, a nationally recognized expert on menopause, and has been featured in numerous outlets, including CNN, Good Morning America, Oprah, just to name a few. And she is a medical director of patient education and community outreach for Midi Health, focusing on women's health issues. She also has her own wonderful podcast called Inside Information Podcast, Menopause Podcast, which I highly recommend. I've listened to several episodes. Lauren, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Well, thank you for having me. And I'm so glad that you led with the idea that women are confused, because it is so confusing. You listen to one person and they very definitively tell you one thing, and then you either listen to another person or go to your trusted doctor and they tell you the exact opposite. And women are literally tearing their hair out saying, when experts disagree, who am I supposed to believe?
Yeah. And your work has helped so many people. But the real reason this started to come up in my world is I did notice that I see a lot of perimenopausal and postmenopausal women. And I notice when I'm taking their history and their medications that so few of them are on hormone replacement therapy. Yeah. And yeah. I think there's kind of that, there must be a gap in education. And like we talked about, the confusing nature of it that makes it so hard for women to consider it or doctors to consider prescribing it.
Exactly. And a study came out just last week looking at new statistics. And in 2023, it is absolutely shocking that the use of hormone therapy is now at an all-time low, with only about 3% of postmenopause women using it. And it's probably actually a little bit higher than that, because that only takes into account the, you know, the standard commercial prescription hormone therapy. A lot of women are going the compounded route, so it's a little bit higher. But even so, the point is well over 90% of women who might benefit are not. And to your point, when you say, why is that? Not only is it confusion, and not only is it that women aren't getting the right information, but because doctors are not trained in hormone therapy, particularly people who started to practice in the last 20 years after that big study, the WHI, came out, and it just wasn't part of their training. So women are not even given the option.
Wow. Why don't we start with some of the basics, like what does estrogen and progesterone do for a woman's body?
The thing that's actually surprising to women is that estrogen does things all over the body. You know, people think about estrogen as just being something that is important to the reproductive organs, to either, you know, getting pregnant or getting your period or your uterus or your tubes or your vagina or your vulva. And the truth is that estrogen receptors are everywhere. They're in the brain. They're in the skin. They're in the blood vessels. They're in the urinary tract. So when you say, what does estrogen do for your body? The list is really, really long. But when we think in terms of what happens at menopause when someone's estrogen tank is suddenly on empty, the way I think of it is okay, as you said, what's estrogen been doing for your body? And now what's going to happen because you don't have estrogen? And there's the short-term things and the symptoms that someone might experience. But then we look at the big picture. What are the long-term downstream effects of no longer having estrogen? So what does estrogen do for you? It keeps your bones healthy. It keeps your cardiovascular system healthy. It keeps your genital urinary tract healthy, in addition to the fact that, of course, it's going to keep your reproductive system going.
Yeah. And we hear about hot flashes and night sweats. And now in preparation of this, I've been talking to more and more women and how it can be so debilitating for some women and it affect their quality of life. So even when we talk about those as their traditional symptoms, it seems like it's much more involved than just saying hot flashes and night sweats.
And let me take that a step further, because the majority of women who have hot flashes, and we're talking close to 80% of women have hot flashes when they go through peri and postmenopause. What they don't realize is that, number one, how long they're going to last. Now, we have very good studies that tell us exactly how long a woman can expect to get hot flashes. And on average, Caucasian women have hot flashes for about 7 years. Black women get them the earliest and they last the longest, 10 to 12 years, even longer. Asians tend to have hot flashes for the shortest period of time. And we used to say, well, is this dietary? Is it lifestyle? No, it's genetic. But the second really important thing that women need to know about hot flashes are not harmless. There's this ridiculous notion that, okay, if you have hot flashes, dress in layers, get a fan, put an ice pick on your neck. And what women need to appreciate is that every single time they have a hot flash, there's a surge in cortisol, there's an inflammatory reaction throughout the body, the heart rate goes up, blood pressure goes up. There's an entire cascade of effects, which over time, we're talking 7 to 10 years and most women or longer, over time is going to harm the body. So specifically, if you look at women who have the greatest cardiovascular changes in menopause, it's the hot flashers, bone loss. It's the hot flashers, brain issues. It's the hot flashers. So this idea of, okay, a hot flash, you know, tough it out. No, we got to treat those hot flashes. We got to make them go away. Not necessarily with hormones. We might get to that. There's a lot of ways to make these hot flashes go away beyond hormones, but the idea of tough it out is just not the right way.
And when you do treat those, does that start to make some of those other problems that you mentioned, whether it's brain or heart cardiac health, get better if they don't have the hot flashes?
Yes, yes. I mean, part of it also is the timing of when you're treating it and the specifics. So if you look at, as an example, if you look at the association of hot flashes with cardiovascular disease, if you start to treat your hot flashes 10 years after you started having them, it's too late. It's too late. The damage is already done. You really have to kind of get into the details of what if someone goals, what are they experiencing, and what are their particular risks?
That's incredible information. And even in my research for this, other than your podcast, I haven't even seen much on that, which is such an important carrot for patients to say, hey, I want to take ownership of this, and for our society to look at it, like you said, not as a inconvenient symptom, but a real indicator of potential things that they could help themselves with.
Yeah. I mean, the way I always put it is we look at two things. We look at quality of life. Very important, not minimizing that, but then we look at length of life. How is this going to impact on the risk of getting significant medical conditions down the road?
Yeah, I mean, even with some friends, I was laughing with her, but she is in her 40s and starting to have night sweats, and she's talking about how essentially she has to put a special pad down, she changes her clothes 3 times a night, and we laugh about it, but at the same time, obviously it affects her libido, it affects just being able to sleep through the night, and that has consequences.
Yeah. And beyond that, we look at the impact of those night sweats on sleep, and we know how important sleep is. And there's very good data that shows that for women who get less than 5 hours of sleep a night and it's persistent, they have up to a 70% increased risk of having heart disease. In addition to the fact that you can't think the next day, you can't function. Yeah. You know, so many women, their primary complaint when they come to talk to me, when they would come to the menopause center, is I'm gaining weight. Yeah. And the first question I ask is, well, how are you sleeping? And they're like, what? That's not why I came to talk to you. I just want to, you know, I want to know how to lose weight. And I'm like, you're not going to lose that weight unless you start to sleep, because that's going to mess up your hunger hormones, the leptins, the ghrelins. You're nowhere. You're going to exercise the next day if you're exhausted. You're going to make bad food choices. And in fact, that has been shown in the research that sleep is one of the, not the only parameter, but one of the major, major factors that impacts on weight gain. But the other thing also with your friend is, in addition to all the issues in terms of just quality of life and relationship and libido and sex and all the things that you can think of, is the impact it has on work. You know, there's a very, very big body of literature now looking at the fact that women who are not sleeping, that are having night sweats, that are having brain fog, are not functioning at work. And they are losing promotions, they're losing their jobs, they're making mistakes. It's devastating.
Wow. This information, I think, really needs to still, with all your work, it still needs to get out there more. And I understand that hormone replacement was actually pretty common until the Women's Health Initiative study got published in the early 2000s.
So the story is the Women's Health Initiative was released 20 years ago, 2004, 2005, around then. And I actually have a podcast episode on the history of estrogen, which I love history of medicine stuff, and I find it really interesting. But it was basically once it started to be commercially available, Premarin was the one option that there was back then. And Wyeth Ahearst, the company that produced Premarin, they did their own version of social media and they published books that said this is the fountain of youth and every single woman should take this. And not only is it going to make you sexy and live longer and happier and, you know, on and on and on. So yeah, I mean, they were giving it out like candy. And the purpose of the WHI was not to determine if it worked in terms of hot flashes and all that, because they already knew that. The purpose of the WHI was to determine if it prevented long-term problems like heart disease and cancer. And what they found is at year five, that there was actually an increased risk of some cardiac issues and breast cancer. So they abruptly stopped the study. And then the word got out that, oh my God, estrogen is dangerous. Estrogen is poison. Don't take it. And sales plummeted and have continued to plummet ever since then. Now, without getting into all the details of the study, because that would take way too long, but the bottom line, what people need to know, sometimes you hear it was a bad study or it was all debunked. It wasn't that it was a bad study. It was that it was designed improperly. And 70% of the women in that study were over the age of 60 because they wanted people in the study who didn't have hot flashes so they wouldn't know if they were getting the real stuff or not real stuff. So you have women that were at least 10 years out into menopause for the most part, sometimes much longer. The damage had already been done. They had them on an oral estrogen. There were so many other things that influence that outcome, and that we now know with a reevaluation of the WHI that the results are very different, in addition to the fact that we now have the option of using so many other hormone therapies that are actually much safer. But be that as it may, we're having a heck of a time getting that information out, both to doctors and to the women. You know, I straddle both worlds. You know, I'm very academic. I'm out there. I just spoke at the menopause conference. I'm speaking to doctors all over the world at medical conferences all the time. And they just look at me like, I had no idea. Yeah. Good doctors, otherwise really good doctors. And so no wonder the women aren't getting the right information.
Yeah. The cardiac risks and the stroke and blood clots were higher. But like you said, a lot of those women already had higher risk factors. They were older starting those.
And the other important point when you look specifically at blood clots is that was with an oral estrogen. When we look at the different ways that you can give someone a systemic estrogen, just to be clear, I'm not talking about local vaginal estrogens that people use on the vulva vagina. I'm talking about people that are taking their hormone therapy to relieve hot flashes and brain fog and for bone health. So systemic. And there's really two basic ways to give it. One is orally, you swallow a pill, and the other is transdermal. You put it on the skin, either in the form of a patch or a spray or a gel or something like that. So what we now know is that it's only oral estrogens that increase the risk of blood clots. Transdermal estrogens do not have an impact on blood clots. So that's really important information. And even if you look at the oral estrogens, the numbers are not high. When you look at the WHI and it says, whoa, it's double the rate of blood clots. Yeah, but how many women who are 45 get a blood clot anyway? Not very many. So it's like saying if one out of a million dies, they get struck by lightning and you double that, which sounds bad, but it's only two out of a million.
Right. And that's how you would interpret the confusion with some of the sensational headlines that you saw in the news. The same thing with breast cancer. I understand there was like one more case and it got interpreted as 25% increase.
So the breast cancer data is really interesting because that's really, of course, what freaks women out, even though heart disease is what kills most women. Most women worry far more about breast cancer. Yeah. And there's this idea that if they walk in the same room with an estrogen molecule, they're suddenly going to get breast cancer and nothing could be further than the truth. So if you look at the WHI, why was there that increased risk of breast cancer? We're There were three groups of women in the WHI. There was the placebo group, the control group that got no hormone therapy. There were women that got estrogen and a progestogen. You had to take a progestogen to protect the lining of the uterus. And the third group were women who'd had a hysterectomy, so they didn't need the progestogen. Well, guess what? The only group that showed that slight increase in breast cancer was the group that got the estrogen and the progestogen. The estrogen-only group, not only did they not have an increase, they had a decrease. They were 21% less likely to get breast cancer. And if they did get breast cancer, they were 40% less likely to die from that breast cancer than in the general population. So it's exact opposite. You know, it appears that estrogen is actually protective. The other thing also that's interesting about the breast cancer statistics is that, think about this. You have a population of women that are suddenly being watched very, very closely. Most women are terrible about getting their mammograms and doing their self-exam and all the things that they need to do to be screened for breast cancer. So you take this group of women that are enrolled in this big study, and they're being seen all the time. They're all getting their mammograms. They're all getting breast exams. So just based on that alone, you are going to find breast cancers that would otherwise not have been found. And if you look at biologically how long it takes from the beginning of a breast cancer to show up on a mammogram, unless it's an aggressive breast cancer, it's years. You know, it is not months. So when you say, okay, these women enrolled and within 3 years they're finding breast cancers, it's because those breast cancers were already there.
Right.
And they were finding them, and perhaps the hormone therapy might have been a little bit fertilizer to their breast cancer to make it show up quicker, but it didn't cause the breast cancer. And that's a very big difference.
Right. And we should talk about the different kinds of hormone replacement, because what I understand is the progesterone used in that study is different than these micronized or bioidentical progesterone.
Correct. So the progesterone that was used in that study was medroxyprogesterone acetate. The trade name was Provera. And it appears that that particular kind of progesterone is responsible for that slight increased risk of breast cancer. Primarily, when we look at what we prescribe now to protect the lining of the uterus, it's going to be a micronized progesterone, which has not been shown to increase the breast cancer. And we also have a lot of alternatives for people who just don't tolerate progesterone. Some people get a little bloated, they get a little, you know, depressed and all of that. So the theme of this whole thing is we talk about precision medicine, whether you're talking about what you do or in the cancer world, the idea that it's not one size fits all. We now appreciate that everyone is different and that you can't just prescribe the same thing for everybody. So it's the same in the menopause world. When we're deciding what kind of hormone therapy is best for someone, there are so many different things that we take into consideration. It's very nuanced, but this is also what makes it tricky, because again, you're just general OBGYN or internist or family practice doctor is very unlikely to really know this stuff. And even if it is someone who's like, okay, yeah, I'll prescribe hormone therapy, or I know a little something about it, if they only have one kind of hormone therapy that they're prescribing, that's a big red flag.
Yeah.
Like if someone goes into their doctor's office and says, I'd like hormone therapy, and their clinician says, sure, I'm going to write a prescription. And then if you say to them, well, why did you choose that particular one for me? Why did you choose an oral versus a transdermal, or a transdermal versus this, or this particular product versus this? If they don't have a good answer for you, that's, you know, you got to kind of say, okay, is this person really an expert?
Right, right. I mean, the devil's in the details and understanding and keeping up to date with the latest literature and studies. It sounds like you feel comfortable saying that the micronized progesterone would be something you would give to a patient who may have a family history of breast cancer or endometrial cancer. Or how do you manage patients with the family history or with a personal history of breast cancer?
Okay, first of all, let's talk about family history, because there's family history and then there's family history. You know, a lot of people are like, oh, I have a family history because my aunt's sister's mother had breast cancer when she was 97 years old. That's not a family history. And I don't know about you, but I'm sure you've had the same experience that I've had. You get two people from the same family. And isn't it amazing how their family history is completely different? You know, the first one says grandma died from brain cancer, and the second one says grandma got hit by a truck. So, you know, family history, you always have to take that with a grain of salt anyway. But this idea that you can't take hormone therapy if there is a true family history, a first-degree relative, you know, mother, sister, whatever, is just not true. Again, I've already established that estrogen is protective, right? So what's interesting is I actually just taped one of my podcast episodes that it was a Q&A on people with cancer and managing menopause. So I did it with a friend of mine who's a specialist in this, and we whipped through about 50 questions, and in 45 minutes, it was crazy. But a lot of the questions were along the lines of, okay, so I have a BRCA mutation, or I have a family history, and I'm going to take estrogen. Are some estrogens better for the breast than other estrogens? And the answer is yes, it does appear to be the case. And in fact, it's the exact opposite of what people think, because there's this, you know, people, the buzzword is bioidentical.
Yeah.
You know, bioidentical is a marketing word. It was never a medical word. Did you ever learn about bioidentical when you were in medical school? Of course you didn't, because that word didn't exist. You know, it wasn't a real medical word. It was something that marketers dreamed up like organic food to make people feel like this is going to be really good for you. But be that as it may, everybody thinks that bioidentical is going to be the best estrogen for you because it comes from a plant and therefore it's natural. And the truth is that the estrogen that is the most breast protective is the one that comes from horse urine, conjugated equine estrogens, Premarin. And when people say, well, you know, shouldn't you just do something natural? Well, we're a lot closer to horses than we are to plants. And what's more natural than horse piss? I'm just throwing that out there. So, you know, again, you got to look at the data. You can't go with the language and the feel good stuff. So as far as estrogen goes right now, that seems to be the most breast protective. And when you look at the progestogen, the micronized progesterone doesn't appear to be protective, but it doesn't appear to be harmful either. The progestogen alternative that is protective is something called basodoxifen. And basodoxifen is actually a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And it is in a product called Duave, and I do not work for this company or any other companies. Any information I give on your podcast, my podcast, or any other podcast is free of commercial financial attachment, but that is absolutely the most breast protective. But this idea that people get so nervous, it's like, oh my God, you know, I have an aunt with breast cancer, so I have to do the thing that's going to protect me the most, is not necessarily the case.
Makes sense. And it also kind of makes, I guess, a little sense that conjugated estrogens, it's a combination of different estrogens, whereas my understanding is a bioidentical, quote unquote, is the most potent form, estradiol.
It's estradiol. Yeah. It's beta estradiol, which is what we make. I mean, that's where this whole bioidentical thing came along. We make beta estradiol. We make a number of other estrogens too. There's a whole lot of estrogens that we make, but the one that's the most active is estradiol.
And then with your practice, when you see somebody older, and let's say they haven't got to you in time for their early menopause, perimenopause, and haven't started hormone therapy at that time, do you treat them differently? They come in, they're maybe 60 or 65, like the WHI studies.
We do. It's a terrific question, because that's where things get really complicated and really nuanced. Because if you look at the WHI study, and very clearly, the women that did the best were the women that were within 10 years of their menopause transition or under the age of 60. But it's not like some terrible, terrible, horrible thing started happening after age 60. The majority of those women did do just fine. And as a sweeping generalization, what appears to make the difference is what someone's cardiovascular risk is. So if someone already has plaque in their blood vessels, if they have significant cardiovascular disease, that's someone who probably is not going to do well on hormone therapy. If, on the other hand, someone has very clean vessels and is at very low risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly if you give them a transdermal preparation that doesn't increase the risk of blood clots, then they are generally going to do better. So this is one of those that we work in conjunction with a cardiologist who's in the know, which is not true of every cardiologist, who kind of gets this whole thing and do things like, you know, calcium scores and carotid artery calcification and all that, so that we can really determine what their risk factor is. But the bigger issue is, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, if someone's 65 years old and they come to me and they say, well, I've never taken hormone therapy and I hear it's really good for the brain, so I'd like to start now. That's very different than the person who says, I'm still having hot flashes or this, that, the other. So it really comes down to, what are your medical risks? What are your goals? So it's beyond just how old you are. It's very individualized. So are there times when I would start someone on hormone therapy over the age of 65? Yes. but it is very nuanced. I have a podcast episode on that I did with one of my favorite experts, Dr. Jim Simon, who is a guru when it comes to this stuff. And it was all about starting hormone therapy after 65. Now, the other thing that's a little different, that's a little bit different question, but comes up is, what if you want to continue hormone therapy after the age of 65? Because we've already established that the best time to start it is early, right? But a lot of people are told that once you have been on it for some arbitrary number, you know, 5 years, 10 years, or once you get to some arbitrary age, that you're supposed to go off. And none of that is true, of course. None of that's based on science. It's all ridiculous. And in fact, we have an incredibly good literature, including a study that just came out 2 weeks ago. I think it was 11,000 people who were on hormone therapy who continued them beyond age 65. They were still taking it. Some of them have been on it for 20 years or more, and they were doing great. They were doing great in terms of they didn't have higher cancer disease, they didn't have higher cardiovascular disease, all that kind of stuff. So there's a big difference between starting it after 65 and continuing it. And the other thing that was interesting about that study is when they interviewed the people and say, why did you choose to stay on it? And the ones that went off, I mean, some of them were still having flashes and all that, but a lot of them, it was because of the joint pain, which is something we didn't talk a lot about yet. But a lot of people, their primary symptom is not hot flashes. It's not brain fog. It's not insomnia. It's joint pain, muscle pain, body pain, and hormone therapy. There are estrogen receptors in the joints, in the muscles. There's a friend of mine who's trying to coin the phrase musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause, looking at the impact of losing your estrogen on the entire musculoskeletal system, the increased risk of frozen shoulder and all that kind of stuff. So a whole nother interesting area.
Yeah. And it's what we had talked about in the beginning. The estrogen receptors are everywhere. And
everywhere.
Yeah, we didn't spell it, including the skin.
Well, the skin, the mouth, and the epiglottis. Did you know that women, after they go through menopause, are at increased risk for sleep apnea, even if they're not snorers, even if they're thin, because the epiglottis becomes stiffer and the voice changes. It just goes on and on and on. Dry mouth. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
So then along those same lines, with that study, do you feel comfortable putting people indefinitely on hormone replacement, or how do you interpret that information?
Yes. So my approach to that is, if I have someone who's taking hormone therapy and has been on it from the get-go and they're doing well, I would never say to them, it's time to stop.
Yeah.
It's a discussion, you have every year. How are you doing? Do you want to continue? If you're doing well and you want to continue, there's no reason to stop. So then you say, okay, well, what's going to happen if they do stop? And that's going to be different for everyone. Some people are going to stop and feel exactly the same. Other people are going to stop and they're going to have the achy bones and they're going to start to flash depending on where they are in this whole thing. But the other thing that doctors are not telling their patients is that when you look at bone health, is so important. And what we know is that women who take estrogen, particularly early on, if they have low bone mass, also called osteopenia, that prevents the progression of osteopenia to osteoporosis. But if you stop your estrogen, you're going to lose that benefit and you're going to lose that bone. So before people just abruptly stop hormone therapy, I think it's important to have the discussion of, what is it doing for you? What is it not doing for you? And if you're going to go off, what are you going to do to protect your bones? And along the same lines, a lot of people have this idea that I'm done with menopause, and what they really mean is they're done with hot flashes. But if you look at the changes in the vulva and the vagina and the bladder, that's never going to go away. Mm-hmm. And if you treat it, it's going to be fine. But if you stop treating it, it's going to go backwards. And so a lot of women, they are told to go off their hormone therapy, or they think that they should go off their hormone therapy, and all of a sudden they're having vaginal dryness and recurrent urinary tract infections and urinary urgency and all this stuff, because no one told them the impact that estrogen was having on everything below the waist.
Yeah, maybe we should back up, because there's so many indications for possible hormone therapy. So we've talked about joint pain, muscle pain, obviously the effects on the vagina, libido, breasts, the effects on the brain.
Brain fog.
Yeah, brain fog.
Mood, depression, perimenopausal, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of stuff with cognition. You know, can't remember why you walked into the room. A lot of that stuff, fortunately, is temporary. But then we look at, does it have a long-term, is it can prevent dementia or Alzheimer's down the road? The jury is actually still out on that, depending on which studies you look at and who you talk to. Another very complicated area that the pure academicians will tell you, we do not have the data to support giving estrogen to prevent dementia down the road. A lot of the social media experts that are out there are saying the exact opposite. So yet another example of people getting mixed messages.
Yeah, I have a mother and mother-in-law, both with Alzheimer's. So in that case, if someone came to you and said, hey, I don't have hot flashes, but I'm thinking about my mom, and what would you tell them about starting hormone therapy?
So this is my message to women in that situation, because if someone says, I'm terrified, my mother, my grandmother, my aunt all had dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and I don't want to find myself in the same place, what can I do to prevent it? Well, the first thing I would tell them is that there are so many lifestyle things that have shown to make a significant difference. Sure. You know, we're talking in terms of exercising, moving, making sure that you can hear. There's a whole battery of your hard of hearing. I mean, there's a very long list of that things that you can do that are alcohol. I mean, on and on, all the things that you can do to prevent dementia. And you can't minimize that enough. When you look at, I don't know if you know, watch the Blue Zone, you know, and how well they do. And so much of it's because of their social interaction and community and the fact that they're so active. So that's at the top of the list. Okay. Yeah. But then to your point, when you say, okay, but what about hormone therapy? And what I would tell somebody is, we don't have the definitive data. We have data that suggests that it may be somewhat preventive. We have some studies that show that there appears to be less amyloid deposition, which is, of course, what we find in people who have Alzheimer's disease. We have data that shows that women on estrogen have less tau tangles, those tau tangles in the brain that are also associated, but we don't have what we call longitudinal prospective data that shows if you take estrogen, give it to a large population of people, is that in fact going to decrease dementia? And people say, okay, but we're not going to have those studies for another 15 years. I can't wait. Right now, tell me what to do. And what I'm going to say is I don't think that estrogen is harmful to you. I mean, I think really the kind of that's, I have such a comfort level with it that I'm like, I can't tell you definitively if it's going to decrease your risk and it's important to do all these other things.
Right.
But having said that, if you are otherwise a good candidate for estrogen and you want to take it, I'm not going to deny you. I just think they need to know and to be informed what we do know and what we, you know, the absence of data is not the same as data.
Yeah. Let's say we have a young woman come into the office and start having hot flashes and sweats. Yeah. When you talk about the different routes of administration, transdermal and oral, I understand the transdermal has less side effects, less overall risk profile. Why would you consider doing an oral versus a transdermal? It seems like transdermal is the way to go.
Yeah, it's a good question. And the way that I approach this is when we look at what kind of choice someone's going to make. And it's based, of course, on personal preference. Some people prefer to swallow a pill. It's going to also, quite frankly, be driven by insurance. Okay. And then we look at, is there an advantage to them? So if I have someone who has no risk of blood clots, super low risk for blood clots, normal triglycerides, normal cholesterol, who really has no issues, it's fine for them to take oral if they prefer that. This idea that oral is dangerous and transdermal is safe is going too far. It's saying we know that there are advantages over transdermal, but it doesn't mean that oral is bad for you. It's really identifying of who's at risk. So someone who's, I mean, think about this. Women are on birth control pills, right?
Right.
So you take your typical woman who say 42, 43 years old, and she's taking a birth control pill. What is birth control? Birth control is hormone therapy. It's high dose, even the lowest dose birth control pill is high dose hormone therapy for the purpose of suppressing their ovaries so that they don't ovulate, so they don't get pregnant, right? So women are like, fine with that. It's like, sure, bring it on. I'll take my birth control pill. And then the minute you take them off their birth control pills, and we can talk about the timing, and then you say, okay, now it's time to talk about hormone therapy. And they're like, oh no, that's dangerous. And it's like, are you kidding? We are talking. In fact, you use the term hormone replacement therapy. Have you heard me use that term once? No, you have not, because we're not replacing. We're using hormone therapy. We're giving low doses to prevent symptoms. So the point is that while you think, why would anyone use an oral because it has this increased risk profile, it's still really, really safe. And a lot of it is personal preference. And the other thing I mentioned, that drug Duavay, which has the basodoxifen, that is oral, right? So if someone says, I want the hormone therapy that is going to give me the greatest breast protection, that's going to be a conjugated equine estrogen with basodoxifen. That does not come in a transdermal preparation. So again, precision medicine.
Right.
What's their risks? What's their goals?
And you already mentioned for the conjugated estrogen or Premarin that has a lower potential.
Seems to be more breast protective. Yeah.
Right. Breast protective. Are there times that you use the bioidentical then, or is it?
Sure. Absolutely. I don't have a problem with it. And again, there haven't been any head-to-head studies. Let's just be clear about that.
Right.
You know, the data that we have from the WHI is robust data because there were so many women in that study and they happened to use conjugated equine estrogen. We don't have those kinds of numbers with beta estradiol. So it may be that we will have studies 20 years from now that show that they're equivalent in terms of breast protection. We just don't have that data. So, and it's always kind of confusing because, you know, for us, we know that these head-to-head trials very rarely exist because why are two companies going to test their drug against another company when it may not come out in their favor? So it's very difficult to get these head-to-head trials going. So very often we just don't have that information.
And for the oral contraceptives, I did know that the actual estrogens and the strength and potency of that estrogen is significantly higher. What are your thoughts about long-term use of that or people using that instead of their hormone therapy?
So let's talk about the timing of that, because also this is an area that people get a lot of misinformation. When we think of using birth control pills, of course, they are only FDA approved to prevent pregnancy. They are not approved. You know, we use them off label for cramps and endometriosis. And people have this idea that off label is illegal or something like that. And off label just means, you know, it's just not being used for the use that it was intended for originally by the FDA, but it's still perfectly legitimate and kosher to do that.
Right.
So when we're looking at perimenopause, women who are still kind of up and down and on that perimenopausal roller coaster and their estrogen levels are all over the place, very often they're going to be better off on a low-dose birth control pill than hormone therapy because hormone therapy is too low for them and they're going to bleed through it and they're going to break through. So very often we will have women on a low-dose birth control pill in their 40s, and it's possible to get pregnant. I always say the only people that get pregnant are the people that don't want to get pregnant. The people that do want to get pregnant never get pregnant.
Right.
So then it's okay. Well, when do you switch over? So if you have a woman who is using a low dose birth control pill and she is feeling good and she is doing well and she's not obese and she's not a smoker and you're going to leave her on that pill until age 55. 55 is not a random number. 55 is because the average age of menopause in this country is 51. That's the average age. By age 55, over 90% of women have transitioned to postmenopause. So that's the time to transition someone from their birth control pill to hormone therapy. So there's no advantage to continuing hormone therapy after that. And we also don't have data on women over the age of 55 who are taking those higher potency estrogens. So that's the general plan.
Then when you're managing, you start at a low level for their symptoms, like testosterone, you're modulating your level based on their response to the hormone. So if they have, whether it's a hot flash.
Testosterone's a whole different thing.
Well, I want to get to that one too.
We'll get to that. So when you say, okay, how do you decide what dose to give? Okay. So there are typical doses that we know are going to protect the bones. You don't want to give too low because it doesn't do any good to knock out the hot flashes if someone's going to lose bone. As long as you're giving hormone therapy, you want to at least get the benefit.
Right.
So you're going to give a dose that's going to protect their bones and that is hopefully going to get rid of their symptoms, their hot flashes. And if it's not, then you go up. One of the many, many differences between managing hormone therapy and we're talking estrogen versus testosterone is we generally don't check levels. Testosterone therapy in women, we do check levels. We'll get to that in a second. But estrogen, we generally do not check levels because it's really more about symptoms, how you feel, and all of that. Do I ever check levels? Of course I do sometimes, particularly if I'm giving someone, you know, what I consider to be a lot of estrogen and they're still having problems.
Yeah.
I want to see, are they absorbing? Is there something else going on? Some people don't absorb very well transdermally. Some people, we need to switch them to an oral. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why I might get levels, but we don't manage it according to the levels. Testosterone therapy, on the other hand, we have to be really, really careful as far as watching levels to make sure that we don't go too high and have issues as a result of that.
Right. People would be pretty surprised at testosterone levels. If you just looked at the picograms per milliliter level of testosterone, it's actually significantly higher than in women than estrogen and progesterone by a factor of some sort. And so obviously it plays an important role in both men and women.
It does. And I always say that testosterone is not a male hormone. It's a human hormone.
Yes.
And all humans have it. Men have about 10 times as much as women. Yeah. And they tend to have more of it that is in the unbound active state. But the other thing about testosterone with women is that, as you know, we make about half of our testosterone from the adrenal glands, and then the other half in women is from the ovaries. But it's not the same part of the ovary is where estrogen is produced. So a lot of women assume that when they stop making estrogen, they're going to stop making testosterone at the same time, and that's not the case. You start to decline in your testosterone levels even before estrogen, and even when your estrogen levels are zero, you may still be making testosterone. So it's highly variable. And the other thing that's highly variable is how someone feels when their testosterone levels are low. There's very little correlation between the actual number and how somebody feels. Mm-hmm. And so testosterone therapy is not something that menopause experts do automatically. If someone is having symptoms, if somebody wants to start hormone therapy, we start with estrogen, we start with the progesterone if they have a uterus, and then we reevaluate and see if this is someone who might also benefit from a little testosterone.
Yeah, what are the benefits and risks of testosterone therapy?
Well, let's talk about the benefits. The only benefit that has been absolutely proven in women is that it can boost libido in about 50%. It's not magic. In about 50% of women, there is a boost in libido. If you look at other benefits, there's a long list of proposed benefits and associations, but very few of them have been proven. So when you look at things like, is that going to help in terms of lean body mass and preventing loss of muscle and cognitive function? And that's, again, one of the controversies that you'll hear on social media. There are a lot of people out there who are really kind of pushing the whole testosterone thing a little bit harder than they should because we don't have great data. A dear friend of mine and a podcaster that a lot of your listeners may know is Kelly Casperson, the You Are Not Broken podcast. And I did a podcast with her a few weeks ago that, of course, because we're good friends, I could give her a hard time. And it's like, oh my God, Kelly, are you giving testosterone to everybody or what? You know, she's a urologist. So,
yes.
And of course, she said, no, people accuse me of that, but that's not true. And I'm like, really? You know. But as far as benefits, really the only thing that we really have good data on in women is the libido thing. And the reason why we don't have a heck of a lot of data is because there is no FDA-approved testosterone for women. Anything that we do is off-label or it's a product that's intended for men. So we don't have the kind of robust studies that we would like. There were a number of times that companies tried to get testosterone from women FDA-approved, and for a variety of reasons, it just didn't happen. When we look at risks, the risks really all come down to levels and dosage. If somebody knows what they're doing and is very, very mindful of the amount that they're giving you and watching your levels, while there's always a chance of acne, facial hair, you know, hair where you don't want it, and you lose your hair where you do want it because you get thinning in your hair, you can get a little bit of enlargement in the clitoris. But that shouldn't happen if you are doing it right. The other thing also that came up at the last menopause conference is that there are a lot of women who are getting testosterone therapy who are not told that they might get lowering of the voice.
Yeah.
And the problem with that, other than that they're unhappy about their voices being lower, is that when you stop testosterone, that's not reversible. The enlargement of the clitoris is not reversible. So I would caution women that are listening to this, that are thinking about using testosterone, is work with someone who knows what they're doing. If someone is giving you pellets, don't walk, run as fast as you can away from them. Women with pellets are the ones that we see the largest disasters. And you really, really want to make sure that it's someone who's kind of following very specific guidelines.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a little bit of the theme today. It's basically that a lot of doctors and patients are misinformed or not up to date on a lot of this stuff, and you need to see an expert like yourself or someone else to manage some of this.
But it goes beyond that. So we kind of have two groups of doctors, if you will, that are doing things inappropriately. The large group are the people who just clearly haven't been educated. They don't know. They might either be not prescribing at all or just kind of winging it. And then we have the scary group, the group that is saying, whoa, there's a lot of women out there who have a lot of money, and I am going to take advantage of this. Yeah. And they are very entrepreneurial. And these are people who can be in all kinds of specialties, whether we're talking emergency medicine and other things, that go and get a weekend certificate, and they call themselves longevity doctors or hormone experts. They never have you take your clothes off. They never examine you. They are doing all kinds of unnecessary blood tests and saliva tests and putting pellets in. Those are the scary ones. And that's not because they don't know. It's because they say they know, and they put themselves out there as experts, and they are doing great harm.
Yeah. Well, I'd be remiss not to talk about the role of estrogen in the skin.
One of my favorite topics.
Can you expand a little bit more on estrogen?
Did you listen to my podcast?
I did. Actually, you know, one of the podcasts I really liked, which we won't have time to talk about, is actually your history on estrogen. I thought that was fascinating, but I didn't listen to it.
Well, I'll tell you the story of how it was that I learned so much about estrogen in the skin, because I always knew that we have estrogen receptors. And certainly when you look at why we have women that wrinkle postmenopause and lose tone and all these other things. So I was giving a lecture at the International Menopause Society in Portugal. And I was giving a lecture on orgasm or something like that, completely unrelated, right? So like 3 weeks before the conference, I get a call from the person who's in charge of the conference. And she said, I need you to give a lecture on estrogen and skin, because the person who's supposed to give the lecture isn't going to make it. And I said, I don't know anything about estrogen and skin. She said, well, you're going to learn. And she said, we're paying for you to come to Portugal and blah, 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 blah. And she was a friend of mine. And so she wore me down. So I said, fine. So like I spent the next 3 weeks reviewing the literature on estrogen and skin, and I learned a lot. And the disclaimer I always give when I give this lecture is I'm not a dermatologist. I don't talk about other things that impact on skin, but I do have some expertise now in terms of the impact of estrogen on the skin. And the bottom line is that estrogen is good for the skin. We know that it helps. We have a very good medical literature, mostly in the dermatologic literature, that shows that women that use estrogen, either systemic or topical on the face, are going to have particularly less fine wrinkles, more collagen, thicker skin. When you look at discoloration, when you look at just bruising and all of that, it's all better. So, but you know that, that's what you do. And I just, okay, let me ask you this. As someone who's doing surgery on the skin, don't you find there's a big difference for women who are taking estrogen compared to women who don't, just in terms of healing and all of that?
Yeah, I think so. I think someone who is actually low on their hormones in general tend to heal a little worse than people who are optimized, for sure.
And so you can actually, this is not FDA approved, but you can get off-label compounded hormone therapy. You know, I mentioned earlier that I work with Midi Health, which is a telehealth company. And and the thing about Midi Health, just to be clear, is they are not like other telehealth. They're not selling drugs. They are giving healthcare. They take insurance. They give you a prescription, which you take to your pharmacy. You know, it's not like, you know, one of these places that just has you pay every month and then sells you drugs. It's completely different. But they do offer some compounded products, and one of them is compounded estrogen for the skin, which is very popular, but it works. I mean, I think that's bottom line. You know, in my history of estrogen, and when I talked about in the skin episode, and I talked about the fact that when you looked at Helena Rubinstein and a lot of the skin experts in makeup world and the cosmetic world, that they had estrogen in all their skin creams and products, which is why they work so well. And then the FDA, of course, got involved and all that went away. But so we have a long history and a lot of data to show that it's safe and it's effective and it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. Can you use your vaginal cream on the face?
You can. And so basically that's estradiol. And one of my favorite derm go-tos is Dr. Ellen Gendler. I don't know if you know her. Dr. Ellen Gendler is wonderful. And she said, and be sure and put it on your neck and your hands too. So she's very big on that. The vehicle, you know, the substance in it isn't all that great. It's not, but that's all right. You put it on and you put on your nice moisturizer, you wash it off. But yeah, it's totally fine. And it's the absorption in the studies. They looked at blood levels and there was no increase and blood estrogen levels in women who were using these small amounts of estrogen on their face.
Right. So now we've found so many different areas where estrogen is helpful, helpful for aging. And you've alluded to that group of people that are looking at possibly monetizing people's desire to have the fountain of youth. But at the same time, we know that estrogen is helpful for so many areas of our body, women's bodies. And what are your thoughts now or potentially even in the future about the concept of being proactive? So someone's not having symptoms, but we know historically that those levels go down throughout microdosing, because we think microdosing is safer. It's just a smaller dose of something, but people are microdosing Ozempic and all these things, right?
I mean, we don't have any data on that. And the other thing also, we've been talking now for what, almost an hour about all the benefits of hormone therapy. And sometimes the takeaway from listening to this is women think, wow, I'm screwed because I'm 5 or 10 years out and I've never used estrogen, or it's too late and this is a disaster. And I think it's just as it is important to emphasize that estrogen is appropriate and safe and beneficial, it's equally important to emphasize that not everybody needs to take hormone therapy, that there are many, many women that do very, very well without taking hormone therapy, and that this idea that I can't take it because I have breast cancer or it's too late, it doesn't mean that you still can't do other things to get rid of your symptoms. We have lots we didn't get in. We don't have time today to get into all the non-hormonal options, but there's many, many non-hormonal options, whether it's, you know, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, whatever the issue is. So I think that's really my overriding message, is that if you are having menopause symptoms or concerned about the long-term repercussions of no longer making estrogen and you want to live as long and healthy as possible, hormone therapy is one piece of that puzzle, but it's not the whole thing. You can't take someone who never exercises, eats nothing but processed foods and smokes a pack a day and then give them a ton of estrogen and think that that's going to make up for that. It's not. And if you look at the difference between lifestyle stuff versus giving someone some hormones, and if you can only pick one, the lifestyle stuff probably has a bigger impact than hormone therapy. And I'm someone who's very comfortable with hormone therapy, obviously. Right. But when someone comes to see me in consultation, or when I'm talking to people and they say, you know, I just don't want to go that route. And I'm like, fine, fine. Right. There's so many other things you can do.
Well, I think that's great advice, because what you're basically saying, we should keep it all in perspective. It's a piece of the puzzle. There's an overall theme. And if somebody wanted to learn more about women's health issues, obviously refer them to your podcast and your website. But where else would you encourage women to go to for a trusted source for health issues?
Yeah, I think the trusted sources, number one is the Menopause Society. It used to be called the North American Menopause Society. They just rebranded. It's now called the Menopause Society. And they have a very robust website that not only has a lot of resources for women, but also has a clinician finder so that they can find someone. And it's not like every single person on their website is great. I've just, we'll put that out there. You can take the test and you could be certified and that's good, but it's still not a guarantee, but it's a good starting place. It's a good starting place. And then also, I used to be completely against telehealth because I was in this, oh, everyone should have their clinician that they sit down to and get their 1 hour menopause consult. Yeah. That's not going to happen. Let's get real here. Right. Most people don't have access. Their insurance isn't going to cover it. They can't find an expert. So some of the telehealth companies, and obviously I'm with MIDI, really is a great, great resource because their protocols are all evidence-based. It's very scientific. They change them as new information comes out. And it has really been a godsend for women who otherwise don't have access to menopause information and menopause care.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time, your work over many, many years, your enthusiasm on the topic and women's health. I think it's tireless and inspiring. And I've really enjoyed your podcast as well. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed I'd Love to Know, please follow us and leave a review on your podcast app. If there are topics you're interested in learning more about, please visit our website at michaeljleemd.com. The information from these podcasts do not constitute medical advice and is meant for basic information. If you're interested in pursuing any of the therapies, medications, or supplements discussed here today, please consult with your physician. I am Dr. Michael J. Lee, and thank you for listening.